Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app. Welcome to Moving Averages, a new financial podcast from Vox Markets. This series will feature expert market analysis, interviews with top traders and commentators, and much more to bring you fresh insights into the world of finance.
Hi, I'm Scott Evans, and you're listening to Vox Markets. On today's podcast, I'm joined by Matt Fletcher, a veteran investor, and I think it's fair to say a self-proclaimed gold bug. By way of a bit of background on Matt, Matt's had a long career in financial markets. He's been a fund manager at Legal & General, an investment analyst at the likes of Merrill Lynch, Pioneer, and more recently, a global investment analyst at Eclectica Asset Manager. He's now a private investor and joins us from his island home in Greece. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Scott. How are you?
I'm good, and welcome to the show. And
thank you.
Really glad you could join us. And how's the weather there in Greece?
It's rather nice. The beach is awaiting and it's sunshine, so all very good.
Great. Matt, the reason I got you on the show is that you recently wrote a research paper, which I found fascinating as I helped edit it, but didn't write it, entitled The Shadow Price of Gold. In the report, you looked at the relationship between the U.S. monetary base, sort of notes and coins and all the rest of it in the U.S., and the price of gold over the past 40 years. I think it's fair to say that your conclusions were that gold is a very undervalued asset class. So maybe we can start by you giving us a bit of an overview of what you mean by the shadow price of gold, how you calculate, and basically the relevance of it in terms of deciding on whether gold is undervalued today.
Yeah, sure, Scott. Happy to. So as far as I'm aware, the methodology behind the shadow price of gold originates in a 2011 investor letter written by Paul Brodsky and Lee Quaintance, principals of QB Asset Management. And quite simply, the calculation uses for its inputs two known quantities. That is, on the one hand, the size of the US monetary base, and on the other, the amount of the official US gold reserves. And we use those two to derive an unknown quantity, which is the shadow price of gold. So whilst the figure for the official US gold reserves really hasn't changed since 2011, that of the monetary base has, and significantly so. So in that respect, I think it's a timely piece of research. I'm going to put a few numbers around this. So the US monetary base is currently $3.7 trillion. And to that figure, we divide that figure by the official US gold reserves of 0.261 billion troy ounces, and we get the number 14,119. So what is this? So what that means is the price per troy ounce of gold required for the US gold reserves to have the same dollar value as the US monetary base, which is the so-called fully backed or 100% backed shadow gold price, is $14,119, i.e. almost 12 times higher than the current spot gold price of around $1,200. Now, before we get too excited, I think it's very important to talk about one of the main findings from the research. I was particularly interested in answering the question, to what extent did the actual price of gold approximate the shadow price of gold as per this calculation? So I back-tested the data over the 48-year sample period, and I'm afraid to say, at the risk of disappointing gold bugs everywhere, I have to report that the answer is not much. And to be precise, the actual price of gold has only approximated the theoretical shadow price of gold in 2 years out of the whole sample period of 48 years. And those 2 years were 1979 and 1980. Now, rather than discarding the methodology outright, I experimented with lower levels of backing of the monetary base. So as opposed to calculating a price of gold in which 100% of the monetary base would be backed, I experimented with different levels. And actually, to my interest, my great interest, I found that if we assume 25% backing of the monetary base, the actual gold price as a percentage of the shadow gold price averaged 100% over the period versus only 30% for when I used the fully 100% backed shadow gold price. Now, In simple terms, what's this mean? Well, to me, it suggests that the 25% back shadow gold price methodology has a certain explanatory power. And on this basis, an implied fair value for gold would be around $3,500 per troy ounce, which is almost three times current levels. Why do I like this methodology? Well, I think it has a certain elegance, given the fact that historically, the global financial system operated on the gold standard, and latterly with the gold global reserve currency being a US dollar directly convertible into gold. Of course, as we know, that direct convertibility was abandoned in 1971 in the so-called Nixon shock, and that paved the way for the abolition of Bretton Woods in 1973 and the move to the current system of fiat currencies.
That's very interesting, Matt. So I just want to pick you up on that last point about the basis of this analysis, if I'm right, is that it's looking back to those days in which the US dollar, for example, was fully backed by gold. And as you said, that's a long time ago since that's happened. So I'm interested, actually, in terms of the relevance of looking at something like the shadow price of gold as an implied value for the current gold price. Is it relevant these days, do you think, to look at those, given that we no longer have a fiat money system, as we call it, in terms of it's not backed by something physical like gold? Do you think it's still relevant to look at those?
Well, Scott, that's really the million-dollar question. And, it's fair to say that the prevailing view on gold by mainstream financial authorities is pretty Keynesian. I mean, it's Keynes famously called gold a barbarous relic. And, you know, you can quite rightly argue what sort of explanatory power or what sort of truth value does this methodology have in a fiat currency system? But I think it's important to examine this more closely because since the GFC, we've had multiple rounds of QE globally, which has driven a huge expansion in the monetary base. And the mainstream thinking on QE, I think, is that it shores up asset prices, it gives the banks time to delever, and it has limited impact on the real economy by way of inflation. Now, I think actually that's missing the point because although we have yet to see the increased size of the monetary base feed through into the official inflation figures, I think at some point I'm pretty convinced it will do. And in fact, my opinion on QE is that the inflation transmission mechanism has been misunderstood. What do I mean by this? Well, let's examine some of the direct impacts of QE. So firstly, via the manipulation of bond yields, QE has the very real effect of robbing savers of the interest they should rightfully earn on their cash balances on deposit with the banks. And secondly, because of lower discount rates in the bond market, the prices of financial assets rise. Now, both of these factors tend to lead to a higher concentration of wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people, which we can see evidenced globally in rising Gini coefficients. So in short, as a result of QE, the returns to labor fall, and the returns to capital rise. Now, ultimately, the volatility in price that QE so effectively suppresses in financial markets, it's my contention this finds expression in voters' choices. So we now see volatility politically everywhere, be this in the US, Italy, or the UK. And interestingly, the parties elected under these auspices have a very natural inclination towards policies that are the antithesis of the pro-globalization liberal economic policies that have been typically espoused by mainstream parties in the past. Why is that important? Well, because we have been told that, pro-globalization, we've got the expansion of global supply chains, this reduces frictional trade costs, and ultimately you're effectively importing deflation from the Far East and suppressing inflation in developed markets. But if we're now flipping that on its head and we're going to get higher costs of doing business, then it's my contention that ultimately this will impact on the first-hand company margins and on the second hand, the prices of goods and services, which are likely to rise. Now, what does this mean? Well, I think the academic research on gold as an inflation hedge is quite mixed. But one of the key findings from my own research is that whilst the actual gold price approximated the 25% back shadow gold price on average 100% of the time over the 48-year period, there was significant variance between periods. So if I look at the 1980s, when CPI inflation was quite high at about 5.5% per annum on average, the actual gold price averaged 220% of the shadow gold price. But as we go into the 2000s and inflation falls, the actual gold price averaged only 62% of the shadow gold price. Now, what does this mean? So if I'm right, the QE-driven increase in money supply does ultimately manifest in higher inflation as one of the side effects of political change, then the potential impact on the gold price could be significant. So my research has shown that CPI inflation of 3%, as prevailed throughout the 1990s, resulted in the actual gold price trading at an average of 85% of the 25% backed shadow gold price. So for those of us who believe that inflation is not dead and that a 3% on the CPI by all historical standards is not an extreme level, then my methodology would point to an effective gold price of around $3,000, which if it came to pass would mean a return of 150% on a long gold position entered at current price levels.
Okay, that's very, very interesting. I think it was a point there I just wanted to pick you up on, was on inflation, because you said that the academic work has shown a very mixed view of gold as an inflation hedge. And I think for a lot of us out there, we often use, or we would think of gold as being sort of the perfect hedge for rising prices. So you'd say, you're looking at it in two ways, really. You're saying, well, actually, the academic work over the longer term hasn't really shown that. But at the same time, we doesn't need inflation to be a lot higher than it is at the moment for gold to be to be significantly higher. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is, Scott. And I think, as with gold, there's so many contradictory answers. So the academic research, I think, is unanimous on the fact that gold isn't a great inflation hedge in the short term. But on the long term, they're in disagreement. Some say it is, some say it's not, and some say it is some of the time. So not really helpful. But you're quite right. On the findings from my own research, I think the key point to get across is you don't need to envisage some sort of, Weimarist nightmare of hyperinflation to get a significant return on gold from the current levels. Because if we get back to that 3% on the CPI, then as we've seen in the 1990s, then the actual gold price could approximate 85% of the theoretical shadow gold price. And the return on that basis would be significant. And
that is a very significant return. But just looking at gold as an investment asset class in general, I think you and I both know that really does split opinion amongst investors. Some will see it as a fundamental part of what is quite often called real asset investment. And some see it as, you've already said about what Keynes thought about it, but almost uninvestable. Why do you think there is such a disagreement between the relevance as gold for investors?
Well, gold's a real conundrum. And so for someone interested in valuation like myself, it offers a real challenge. So if we look at gold versus equities or bonds, the first thing we notice is that it's a non-yielding asset. So if I own an equity, I get an annual dividend. If I own a bond, I get probably a semi-annual coupon. Now, that makes those two financial instruments relatively easy to value. So if I look at equities, I can discount my annual dividend stream using the Gordon Growth Model and come up with a value for the stock. Or if I'm looking at free cash flow, I can DCF the free cash flow and I'll get a value for the firm on the sort of net present value basis of the future cash flows. Now, obviously, gold doesn't generate anything. We can't do that for gold. And I'd also add to the fact, even worse in some ways, there are very real costs involved in owning physical gold in terms of secure storage. And even if I invest in a physical-backed gold ETF, there are transaction costs to take into account. So the question is the fact that gold is a non-yielding asset, does that make it not an asset because it doesn't have a yield? Now, I don't think this is the case. So although gold is non-yielding, we do have price data stretching back to 1973, when the gold price was allowed to float freely against the US dollar, if you want to put it that way. And it shows the average annual real return in terms of capital appreciation expressed in US dollars is around 2.5% per annum. And in fact, this very valuation conundrum that gold represents really got me interested in alternative ways of trying to value it. And hence, I came across the shadow gold price methodology. And as I said, I think there's a certain elegance there which can help solve a sort of a valuation riddle.
Actually, one other point, and the chart that you've, I think the first chart or the second chart that you have in your research shows what central banks have been doing with their gold reserves over the last sort of 10 or 15 years. So it's another way of really looking at that question in terms of how relevant it is as a store of value, as something which central banks need to have. And we know that the UK was net sellers for many years in getting rid of its gold reserves. Mm. And then you show quite clearly that there was a post-financial crisis, a fundamental change by central banks who were net sellers to net buyers. Do you think that that is clear evidence that they were shoring up the coffers with gold because they see this is very important in a highly sort of volatile financial sector? Or have I missed the point?
Well, that's a really good question, Scott. I mean, perhaps it's worthwhile to begin with just taking a very quick look at the supply and demand characteristics of gold. So, I mean, as far as demand is concerned, the important point to make is gold is not really consumed. So the two basic levers of demand are jewelry demand, fabrication demand, and investment demand, with central bank activity, in essence, being a component of the latter. But if you look at jewelry demand for gold in the Far East, in the Middle East, it's as much to do with the fact that gold's a store of value as it is for the ornamental and decorative aspects. And if we look at supply, you can look over time and gold mining activity typically results in annual supply growth for gold of around 2% per annum. But I think this is pretty much irrelevant. Gold is an imperishable metal. That's part of its, appeal. And pretty much all of the gold ever mined in the history of the earth is still most likely extant. So you can see why, compared to the enormity of the stock of gold, annual supply changes are unlikely to have much impact on the price. And that's very different from something like copper, for example, where most of the annual supply is consumed. And if you get a sudden supply deficit relative to demand, you typically see the expression of that in a large and steep increase in the price of copper. So central banks per se cannot really influence the price of gold on that basis. However, and this is the most important thing, we come back to that Keynesian point of gold, being dismissed as a barbarous relic. And certainly prior to the great financial crisis, the behavior of central banks as being net sellers of gold, I would argue, is very much in accordance with this idea. Now, so the question is, why have they turned net buyers post-GFC? And I think the great thing here is, let's look at the signal they're sending. They're like tipping that Keynesian point on its head. And these guys are right at the coalface of the global monetary system. Are they telling us something about risks inherent in the expansion of the monetary base we've seen over the last 10 years? Do they see a fragility in the system that may manifest at some point in some form of Minsky moment? Is it an implicit comment on the continued hegemony of the US dollar or the possibility of an inflation shock? I don't know the answer to those questions, but I'm certainly intrigued by the signal.
Yeah, very interesting. Actually, that brings us on to another point you made on precious metals. You also calculate the shadow price of silver. I'm very interested if you could just sort of very quickly just go through that and what you think that shows in terms of today's valuation of silver and that relative to gold.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm very interested in silver personally and personally own long-dated calls on one of the physical silver ETFs. So, and why? Well, typically, during a period of increasing gold prices, you would expect silver to increase at a faster rate. So think of silver as a geared play on the gold price, if you will. I'll give you a concrete example of that. In the gold price rally from the start of 2009 to mid-2011, the gold price roughly doubled, moving from around $900 to about $1,800. Whereas the price of silver went up almost four times. It started the period at around $12.50 and topped out at around $46.50. So that makes me interested in applying this methodology to the silver price. And I think it's an innovation of the research that I've done, and I haven't seen anyone else do it. So basically what I've done here is take something called the gold-silver ratio, which is simply the spot price of gold divided by the spot price of silver. So currently, that ratio is 82. We've got a gold price of around $1,200, a silver price of around $14.50. So 82 times 14.50 is 1,200. Now, that is quite extended by historical standards. Over my almost 50-year sample period, the average gold-silver ratio was 56.6. So to derive a shadow silver price, all I do is simply divide the shadow gold price by the long-run gold-silver ratio, 56.6, and we get the following. At 100% backing, a theoretical value for silver of around $250, but at our preferred 25% level of backing of the monetary base, the shadow silver price on the same basis would be $62, which, intriguingly, is just over four times higher than current levels.
That's very interesting, Matt. Final question for me, from me, is that obviously gold has had its days. More recently, in the last 12 months or so, it hasn't been the best investment, especially relative to equities. So in your opinion, when will it have its day again, or should we be buying it now?
Well, Scott, I wish I knew the answer to that. Now, as long-term investors, I think it's always good to take a somewhat contrarian stance and to build positions where, at a time when something is out of fashion and the price is weaker. Now, interestingly, the theme of the day is certainly tech stocks. So if you look at the tech stocks, they're what are driving the US market up to new highs. Now, back when I was working for Hugh Hendry's Global Macro Fund in 2014, I did a lot of research on tech, particularly internet stocks in China, Korea, Japan, and the US. And at that time, I was getting significant upside on my DCF models. And even better, there was a reasonable degree of skepticism still about the earnings potential of these companies. We bought a number of them. We did pretty well out of that trade. But I think today, if I were to rerun my valuation models, I think I'd really struggle to see significant upside from here. And worse for me, these stocks are now extremely well loved by the market. So the implicit contrarian within me is worried. This is no reflection on the companies themselves. I mean, some of these stocks are absolutely world beaters, fantastic companies, but it's the price they trade at and the expectations that are the issue. And, you know, we've seen this before. I'm not really talking about the tech boom that imploded in 2000. Those stocks, many of those stocks didn't even have revenues, let alone profits. But if we look back over time, there's always a time when a certain group of stocks, for whatever reason, become the market darling. So in the 19th century, you had railroads. In the 1960s, you had the conglomerate stocks. And in the 60s and 70s, you had the so-called Nifty 50 blue chips, which you were told just to tuck away and don't worry about. Prices of these were strongly bid up. Consequence, inevitable crash in market prices later on. And I suspect the fate of the current crop of market darlings will ultimately be no different. Now, with that backdrop, I think it makes supreme sense, if you agree with me that gold is an investable asset and has a role to play in a well-diversified investment portfolio, then I think it really makes sense to add on weakness, with the dollar, strong dollar, long bond yield in the US rising. Gold is going to remain weak for a while in that backdrop. But I think if I'm right, and ultimately that inflation number comes through and we edge towards, up from 2% and expectations move towards 3%, then gold should start moving once again.
Matt, that's been very, very interesting talking to you on gold. And if anybody wants to get hold of the research written on Matt, just go to www.sealadvisors.com and go to the publications page. Thanks very much for joining us, Matt. That was a great session. Bye.
Yeah, bye. Bye.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.